Welcome to The Docket, presented by Defense Diaries. I'm your host, Bob Mata, and I'm joined, of course, by my beautiful and brilliant co-host, Allie. What's up, girl?
Hey, babe.
Hey. And we are super excited tonight because the long anticipated, absolutely like dying to have this conversation, our wonderful friends, Brett and Alice from the Fantastic Prosecutors podcast. So excited to see you guys. It's been a minute.
Hey guys. So glad to be here.
Yeah.
And can I just say, yeah. Bob, you're like newscaster voice that you go into when it gets serious. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It's just so smooth. It's like, or it could be like smooth jazz.
Right. Oh, it's smooth jazz.
That's like my scripted. Like I do my scripted and like my radio voice. You know what I mean?
Well, no, but at home, when one of the kids or I, like they say, oh, well, you just used your podcaster voice. He's just like, what do you mean? My voice, I don't do a different voice. That is my voice. So.
Oh, Bob, you do a different voice. I'm not saying it's bad, but it might be a little weird if you're like, Allie, it's time to do the dishes.
Allie. Is it time to go to the amusement park? Let's go, kids.
Oh, my goodness.
I love it.
Well, I think I know. So we're here today to talk about how to get a refund when your hotel room catches on fire and you are sent running into the stairwell. And I'm so glad that we have a personal experience from Bob Mata to be able to talk here tonight for probably about 2 to 3 hours.
Easy.
Just kidding. Just kidding. We
Easy.
Are
I
obviously
can stretch that story out.
We are obviously here because today was the Indiana Supreme Court oral argument in the Delphi murders case. But the litigant was not Richard Allen. Rather, his former attorneys, Brad Rosie and Andrew
Baldwin,
have asked for extreme remedy from the Indiana Supreme Court for three specific things. Number one, to be reinstated as Richard Allen's attorneys after Judge Gull at the trial level removed them. Number two, to have the Supreme Court set Richard Allen's trial within 70 days. And number three, to remove Judge Gull. And today that oral argument happened. And joking aside, Bob really is in Indiana and did sit in at the oral argument. So Bob, thanks for being with us here today. And Allie, I know you were watching on YouTube and giving live commentary, and a lot happened. We're just prefacing for everyone what we're here about today. And I look forward to this discussion. So kind of we'll just start with you, Bob. First of all, after that fire alarm went off, what time did you have to get to the court? And you know, what was the scene around the court?
It was busy. As you'd expect it to be. And it's in the state building. The Supreme Court room that they use is in the state building. So you have all of the hullabaloo of all the other functions of government going on in there at the same time. So it was packed in there. They had like probably 400 kids like there for some kind of award ceremony. We could hear them cheering outside of the actual courtroom. It was muted. But it was, I got there, I was fortunate enough to get a reserve seat, so I didn't have to do the line. So I was lucky in that sense. So I got over there about 10, and just kind of hung out. And, you know, and when you go to something like that, and you guys, I listened to your, legal briefs the other day where you're kind of explaining what people can expect with this type of hearing. It's nothing like watching a trial. It's a very different experience. And, you know, when you're law nerds like we are, it's like the pinnacle. You know, it's like you walk in and the trappings of the courtroom are so beautiful and austere, and you can feel the weight of it, you know, in a different way than it's typical in our state courtrooms where you're just at trial. I mean, obviously, if we're on trial, that's different. But if I'm walking in for a status hearing or even a motion, like you just don't get that feeling often, you know? So it was really, I loved it. I loved every second of it. I just love that everyone in that room, the justices, the lawyers, understand the weight of it and they treat it with the respect it deserves, because it's like, it's the embodiment of our legal system, like encapsulated in a room. And it's just, it's a beautiful thing. And it's so compelling, you know, it's just so compelling. So
what was the press like? Was there a lot of press there? Was it covered up with cameras and everything, or?
Ton of press. Yeah, they were lined up in a lot of, and they carved out some room for pretty much a good majority of the press. It was, the seating, was more than I anticipated, because I was worried going in, because this reserve thing was, I didn't even know. My plan was to go and get in line, you know, and do the work. And, and Kara had like reached out to me because her husband couldn't make it. And she's one of the ones who had drafted the OA, you know, cause I had gotten friendly with her and she's like, would you want to, she's like, you want to come? I'm like, yeah, yeah, please. No line.
Oh, that's yes. You didn't know. And you answered the question that I think a lot of people had. How does one get reserved seats at the Supreme Court? Yeah. But how many people had reserved seats and how many people do you think were watching from the gallery?
I think there were approximately, I'd say best guess, about 60 in the gallery total. So the first two rows, they had reserved and they were probably about, I'd say 10 across. So I think it was like 10 across. So it was 10 on each side of the aisle and it went back six rows, maybe seven, but there was a lot of press there. The families came, the families were there. Of course, Rick Allen wasn't there. Kathy wasn't there. Judge Gull was not there. Apparently she was on a murder trial. And then the state, you know, so the state had, you know, significant others come, like everybody, like Kara's husband was there. He ended up coming. So somebody must have dumped out, man. I wasn't asking any questions.
I think it was Richard Allen's wife
I think it was Kathy, because she was upset because she had only gotten one seat and she kind of wanted a support system there. So she ended up.
But Bob, you actually make a really great point there that Richard Allen wasn't there and Judge Gull wasn't there. I think that's important for people to know, because we've watched a lot of these trials, and obviously every time there was a hearing that involved Richard Allen at the district court, Richard Allen, you know, sits at the table and is present. But appellate hearings obviously are different. We know this, that their legal arguments and your representation is there. And honestly, in my experience, whenever I do appellate work, my client is not there, because it's kind of one step removed, right? We've always said it's on the record. It is not this, you know, judging someone's credibility by their faces and whatnot. So were you expecting Judge Gold to be there, or did you know that she was not going to be there?
No, I heard she wasn't coming a couple of days ahead of time. And interestingly, predecessor counsel wasn't there. So that kind of surprised me a little bit.
Two lawyers before? Is that what you mean?
No, yeah, I mean subsequent counsel, not predecessor counsel. Yeah, Andy and both Andy and Brad were there, but they weren't going to go. Like Kara had to talk them into it, because like Andy was like saying, oh, well, you know, I don't like, it's too much for me, you know, and but I think ultimately it was important that they be there. I mean, they were really, you know, the kind of the impetus of the whole thing. So I think it was important for them to be there, you know, as far as Judge Gold goes, you know, but we'll get into it. It was a fascinating day. You know, it really was.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Alice.
Well, I was just going to set out the parameters for, I'm talking through this because I think a lot of people watching have watched it, but a lot of people have not watched it. So we're not going to give things away. We're going to walk through it. But unlike at the district court level, there are time restrictions. And so today's argument was supposed to take an hour, but it was interesting because it's obviously the movant in this case, attorneys for, former defense counsel gets to go first because it's their, you know, moving. And then the, representation for Judge Gull and the state got to split time, and then there's a rebuttal. And it really stayed pretty much within that hour. They had those little green lights that then turned red when they ran out of time. And I was actually impressed that they stayed within those time limits. But as we'll get into it, a lot of words were said per minute within that hour.
A lot of words from everybody.
So obviously, you know, both of your show and our show, we've talked a lot about this. I think everybody knows where we sort of stood on it. And I gotta imagine, and I'm interested in Allie because we heard enough of you, Bob. I gotta imagine as you were watching sort of how it developed that you felt good about Richard Allen and his former attorney's chances. I mean, that we talked about a little bit on our show that a lot of times you can't tell from the questions the court's asking how they're going to come out. This one, it seemed like, I mean, about even, you know, the first, when the initial, the person who was representing Richard Allen / prior counsel, you know, when he got finished, I thought, well, you know, they asked him some tough questions, but I, you know, it seems like they buy what he's selling. But then when the counsel for Judge Gohl and especially the counsel for the state got up, it was just like a massacre. It just felt like this is not going well at all for them. So y'all had to feel good sort of when it wrapped up.
Well, yeah, I, you know, like, cause we were doing the live. So one of the questions that someone asked was how many of the judges did I think were going to put Richard Allen back on? I was like, all of them. To me, there was never a question. I mean, it was a non-issue. There was no way that the Supreme Court was going to let a structural error like that sit. And I know Brett, at least from Bob telling me, you had some questions about whether when they were court appointed, that the law was as firm on, you know, removing a court appointed attorney, which it's definitely at a point I said to Bob, I'm confused. Why didn't they appeal the order from when they entered their appearance pro bono? And I know, Alice, you want people to understand. So there were two aspects. There was first, these were the court appointed lawyers, and you don't have a right to a court appointed lawyer of choice. So you get who you get. You have, when you have hire private attorney, you have the right to your counsel of choice to be represented by the person who you choose. And that person cannot be removed very easily, but surely not the way this happened, without it be creating what the law calls a structural error. And it's the most serious error that can happen, where there is no balancing. There is no, well, were they prejudiced? Because typically in the law, no matter how bad a trial goes, no matter what the errors are, the end question ends with a balancing. Well, you know what, buddy? The evidence is really strong against you. You're clearly guilty. You weren't prejudiced no matter how bad it was. So when you have a structural error, there's no balancing. There's no considering. That's it. The end. Go back and do it. So as soon as she mentioned the Gonzalez case, I was like, all right, boom, it's done. Because I know that's the case that speaks to structural error in that issue. And then we did have some justices asking about the right to continuing counsel, which was sort of what the issue was, where that kind of Bob would tell me your position and I would say, no, there's some law to support that you have your continuing right, but it's clearly not as black and white as your right to counsel of choice. So I was surprised when they did not include the order of denying them the ability to be private counsel when they agreed to do that, because I thought that was their strongest argument. They did have a strategic reason for doing it that way, but I was concerned because, as Brett, I guess, has pointed out before, the law on continuing counsel is not as black and white.
I don't think they wanted to go back and do it for free.
I think that was clear from rebuttal.
But that was one of the things where, like, when you guys, when it was all going down and you guys were like, well, you know, the thought is, and Brett, I'm like with you theoretically, because theoretically it's the absolute truth. Defense attorneys use the speedy is leverage all the time. It's like we use it as a, you know, strategic move constantly. In this particular scenario, I happen to know that they were serious. They were ready to go to trial. And when Lehman argued it, you know, when he talked about that aspect of what I'm saying strategically for us, when we love trying to be able to catch you guys off guard. You know, in a case like this, They had the sense that McClellan wasn't ready, and they were right about that. I mean, we have McClellan at the I don't know if it was the city board meeting, but you know, like having to beg for $5,000 so they get an assistant to help him. And he's flat out saying, he's like, if I don't get this money, I'm never getting a conviction on this case because I can't do all the work by myself. You know what I mean? So it wasn't a matter of, is he a good lawyer or not? It was a matter of, it's a very small office over there and he doesn't have the kind of help that you need for a case of this magnitude. He didn't have, his now second chair enter his appearance until October 31st. Or no, it was the 19th, whenever the in chambers was.
Cause you that's have when to he tell people who McClellan is. But,
I think most of our collective people all know, but Nick McClellan is, of course, the prosecutor.
It might be, and you know, certainly asking for resources is always a thing both defense counsel and prosecutors are needing, but I don't think it necessarily means that he was asking for resources because the investigation was incomplete. Maybe that is the case. I only mean that when you're gearing up for trial, you typically don't put a second chair or a third chair on until it's on really time, you know, game time for trial, just because, like you said, caseloads are so high, small offices, everyone's doing their own trials until it's like, no, we got to buckle down for this trial. I only mention that because it's very, absolutely, I think that he probably needed more help, but I'm not sure that that means he wasn't finished with the investigation, because we all know the sheer number of exhibits in this case is massive. I've had to do, you know, thousands of exhibits it's a full-time job to like properly redact and do the administrative side of getting ready for trial, which has nothing to do with investigations.
That's 100% what it was. That's what he said. He's like, you know, they're talking about 170 witnesses, like just preparing the subpoenas and tracking everybody down like that. That it wasn't really anything having to do with, I think that he knows the case. I think he knows the evidence backwards and forwards, but it's all the moving parts to be able to prepare for a trial like that, is, you know what I mean? It's like, it's a massive amount of work. I mean, we've been on that side of it with the Garcia case. It was overwhelming. And we had, you know, we had two of our young associates and a third intern, and my father and my PI was living with us. He was our like absolute go-to. Like they drove us back and forth to court, did the cooking in the morning. We get up. It was like some kind of weird logging camp. We all get up, eat breakfast. He had this van that I always unaffectionately call the pedo van. I'm like, this looks like a pedo van, man. I'm like, what is it? But like, you know, he'd drive us back and forth to the, you know, the courtroom, pick us up. So he was indispensable for us, but just all of the logistics and the administrative side of preparing for a trial, which I'm always trying to tell people that there's so much to do. You know, so that's where it was. And as far as Judge Gull went, my position with her was that she just wasn't running the case. You know, forget about the docket stuff. She just had pending motions. And look, she's in a much larger county in Allen with a lot of serious crime. She's got a cram docket, you know, so it's not an easy gig for her at all. You know, and she's trying to come back because when she couldn't get to the memo, you know, like you just knew, and she's admitting on the record, she's like, I haven't even finished reading the memo, and I haven't looked at any of my clerks, haven't even finished going through the exhibits, which are voluminous. You know what I mean? And then there's the pending motion in limine for the unspent casing that they're trying to keep out. Like, so those were floating for months without even a date being set. You know, it shows you. So if we assume, and I have no reason to believe that it's not, that they were authentic in terms of saying, we are going to trial, we're making a speedy demand right after you enter the order with the discovery deadline. Like people were like, well, because they admitted in court today that they had the, you know, that they had the speedy demand in writing since August. And it
Can
makes
I ask you
sense.
A question about that, about yeah. the speedy demand. So at least where we practice, you can make a speedy trial demand, but if you're also filing motions, like a motion for Frank's hearing or motion to suppress, anything like that, that stays the deadline for the speedy trial. The clock doesn't run. So even if they had filed the speedy trial motion until she rules on the Frank's motion, wouldn't it kind of not have any effect anyway?
That's the way it is where we practice as well. It's everywhere that I've practiced. It's been that, you know, you have your speedy trial, right? But if you file a motion, I mean, I've been struggling with that since the first day I walked into a courthouse, because I'm like right now I have a federal case going. I'm like, well, they haven't gotten me all the discovery. So I have to file a motion to force them to get discovery, but my clock has to stop because they're not giving me what I need, or I need something additional. So that has always been an issue. But I don't know if Bob, if you do know, but it sounds like they've got these two different aspects. It's like they have this, you make a demand, you get it in 70 days. So I think during that 70 days, you can be doing whatever you want. But I don't really know for sure. Do you know specifically, babe?
No, I don't. And, you know, the question that raises is if it's the judge's delay. You know, I mean, you can't really put it on the attorneys, but if it's like, it's like, I'm so like, when she's admitting on the record, you know, a year into the case that she hasn't read the motion that was filed at that point, what, a month and a half prior, you know, it's like, it's for me, it was just unusual. Like when we file a motion, when Allie's got a motion on file, we file with, you know, a notice of motion and we're picking a date. Now the judge, of course, may change that, but we're going in and setting a date in order to get, you know, the briefing schedule done. And then Allie's going in and getting the date for hearing. You know what I mean? So it was very unusual the whole way that she was running it.
So I think that's a, you know, that's very helpful to hear, you know, that our jurisdictions are at least similar in how they run that. I think what Brett was getting at is if they really wanted to, you know, catch the prosecution on their heels, as today's, you know, lawyer kept saying, they could, by basically not filing these repeated motions and not filing the speedy trial demand. I'm not saying that's necessarily their tactic, because certainly there are legal motions that need to be filed and need to be ruled upon. But I've certainly had cases, and I'm sure you've had too, where certain things are happening, either like the person keeps sitting in prison and the defense counsel's like, look, let's cut this crap. Let's go to trial, because like, I can't change his mind. You're not going to change your mind. We can file all these motions to compel. We can have discovery fights, or we can withdraw our pending motions and go to trial in a month or even sooner, whatever they want. I've had that situation where it's usually a more limited case than this one. And I think Brett's point is they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. It seems like we want the speedy demand trial, but we never filed for it. But also we keep filing these motions that are going to, by virtue, delay whatever we're asking for.
Like, I assume there'll be a motion to suppress at some point.
I mean, I would think so.
Beyond the
Franks. Technically, there is. They convert, like, there. Remember, the original motion that turned into was really a motion to suppress the search at Allen's home. So that's out there already. You know, I mean, I get what you're saying, but from the perspective of, well, look, you know, like you said, there's motions they have to file. You know, I mean, and that's the thing, like the tenacity by which you use the speedy trial is a double-edged sword, very much so, because it could easily pierce us just as easily as it does you, because it shortens the period of time. Even though we don't have the burden, we still have to prepare for the case, you know, so we're working on shorter time as well. You know what I mean? So it's always a scary proposition. Like on Garcia, like, you know, I always sit here and I'm like, oh man, like I still ruminate about like we should have gone with the speedy on that, you know, because they pulled so much evidence post arrest. Like that thing went on for 3 years.
And for people that don't know, Bob's talking about a serial killer case in Nebraska where we represented an accused serial killer. And there was a football field, literally. I don't know how I didn't take a picture, but it got to the point where they were like, fine, we're going to produce it to y'all and you can figure out what you don't have. And I had a football field.
Literally.
So
they had all the physical, they had a room with all the physical evidence, you know, like everything. It was a lot.
But I do
want to ask you this.
Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, I agree
with Alice, but for a different reason, because I don't understand the whole, I think during that 70 days, they can be doing whatever. But I noted, like, if he really wanted to catch them on their heels on that, why include so much detail in the Frank's motion?
Why have a 1,000-page motion, right? Because, like, you can't, I mean, it takes time to read that. There are certain ways that you can file motions. We do this all the time, especially in motions in limine right before trial. We file, like, 3-page motions because we want a ruling before we go to trial. And we don't actually want those issues pending. So we cut to the heart of the issue. Obviously, there was a lot more. You probably could have said that in a lot fewer pages, probably, you know, a tenth of that. You have your choices, but you know that that's going to delay. So it just seems like they're saying one thing, but maybe they actually did not want to move as quickly as they're claiming now.
I think that there's a bit of a, like, Andy Baldwin drafted the memo. So, and remember, like, Brad and Andy are not in a public defender's office. They're both private attorneys that were appointed as PDs on this case. They both have their own practices in separate towns. So in terms of, like, the memo, like, I don't necessarily know if Brad knew it was going to be 136 pages long.
But Bob, if you want to surprise the state, you don't put all your secrets in the memo right before you go. I mean, that was like my issue. I'm like, well,
I agree. We've
been pretty public about that. I think it's because it was a great way to get your story out there. But here's the thing. You can still do that. Get your story out there if that's what you want, but then withdraw the motion and say, never mind, judge, let's go to trial because it's taking you too long. They can do that. You can kind of have your cake and eat it too. I don't think you should do that. But if what they wanted to do was to get their theory out there, it's on the public docket.
I agree. And that would have been the power move, withdraw it. But then you just go back and file the 6 pages of the 136 that was the actual Frank's motion.
Sure. Right. I agree with you.
That would have been
I just think strategically that would get you your cake and you get to eat it too.
Yeah, exactly. It's clearly very, very transparent what you're doing. You're not fooling anybody with that move. That's for certain. You know, and Gull was already irritated with them, you know?
Yeah, she was going to kick him off kiss anyway, so you might as well do it, right? So I do want to, because we could just talk about this forever, and I hate to jump ahead, but in case, if anybody doesn't know this, I don't know if this happens more often in state court than it does in federal court, but they had the oral argument today. And actually, I talked about an instance where we did this once when I was clerking. So I guess it does happen, but they had the oral argument today. And then like 2 hours later, they released an order without an opinion, and opinion's coming later. They basically said a majority of the court agrees to reinstate the attorneys and then unanimously not going to grant the motion to remove, not going to grant the motion to set the trial in 70 days. Now, I assume that the reason, and I guess we'll know this whenever the opinion comes out, and it might be a while because I suppose there probably will be dissents given the wording. I assume that the reason they did not grant the removal and the speedy trial is because this was mandamus and those weren't really proper requests at this time. So it would seem to me the defense is not foreclosed from moving for one or both of those at the trial court level. Do you think the defense will now, the old defense is new again, do you think they'll walk in on Monday or whatever and file that speedy trial demand that they've been talking about?
Do you want to take a bit? No, I don't. I think that there's going to be some housekeeping that has to be done.
In a week, do you think they'll file the speedy trial demand?
So they already have, like, Rosie filed a motion for her to recuse her. So that's already been filed. Like, during the whole hullabaloo, he filed it. So it's still pending. So that's going to have to get dealt with. And, like, I wanted to ask you guys what your opinion on it was with respect, because Allison and I were debating it. You know, I was sitting at lunch with Mark and Karen. I'm like, well, I thought it was going to go down exactly what happened. I thought that they would reappoint them. I thought Gull would stay on, and I thought the 70-day thing was like, that's not their purview. That's not their problem. And like Allison was like, why? Like, why do you need the court to order that? Just, you know, put your motion in, put your speedy demand in. Like, what do you need the court to do that for? So like, I just think that they're gonna, if I were them, I would wait it out, make sure you like, there is a distinct possibility that Judge Gull is going to you know, like Sue Esponte follow through with her thing. You know, she
follow through
she
as in have, recuse herself.
No, she may follow through with her and have a hearing with regards to whether or not they were grossly negligent. She could absolutely.
I mean, that's gonna be really interesting. Obviously, we don't have an opinion yet. I don't disagree with you. It's gonna be really interesting what the reasons are, because at the oral argument, which I know we haven't talked a ton about, a lot of the questioning to Rosie and Baldwin's attorney was about, should we just remand this for the record? We know what she's going to say, but there isn't a record. You're correct. But then it was interesting because when Judge Gold's representative stood up, all the questioning was about, should we reach the merits of it? So that's going to be really interesting about what the order says. I thought you were going to say, if she's on the case, whether she would choose to recuse, because we are in an interesting situation. The order, two paragraphs long. There's not much there except the kind of, you know, bomb of an order that they are now reinstated and none of the other lower court proceedings are stayed. So you're right. Come tomorrow. There could be things going on, but no one really exactly knows what posture everyone's in. There are pending motions. There's motions from both new counsel as well as former now again counsel. It is a bit in the air and unusual to issue an order like this without some sort of direction as to what the court was thinking. And I think this creates a bit of a mess tomorrow.
There are two possible ways they could have gone on this. You know, it was funny. Allie was talking about when she knew that they were going to win. I knew they were going to win when one of the lawyers was talking about wheat.
When the chief judge said, I don't care about the Supreme Court.
Okay, wait. What's your other case? And it's like, right. Okay.
I think all of us on this call were like, well, if you don't like your case.
I had that happen once.
I'm going to send you the wheat meme. It's so good. It's the chief justice. And it's like wheat intolerant. And it's got a picture. Yeah.
She was definitely like, you know, out there with a sling blade.
She was over chopping down
the wheat. Truthfully, at first I thought the chief judge, I thought her questioning was very incisive. It was, you know, it was a hot bench. So there were five Supreme Court justices, and they all had a lot of airtime in terms of conversation. I can't believe they didn't go over time, to be completely honest. So kudos to them for sticking with
that.
That was a hot bench for those of you who may be new to both of our podcasts, it means that the judges are questioning like crazy. And truthfully, I thought it was hot when, you know, Rosie and Baldwin's attorney was going, but man, it like ramped up to, you know, multiple degrees higher when it was, the respondents.
They stopped
at one point. Yeah, they did, which I got a lot of thoughts on that, but there was one point where the chief justice was asking, I think it was of the state, and she basically said, why not just send it back? They can have a hearing and do it again the right way or something like that. And it really leads to the question of when they issue this opinion, are they going to say basically in Indiana, you just have a broader right to continuity of counsel. Like, we're just going to find a broader right. And she could not remove them for this reason. You know, even if she'd have had a hearing and that's the way it is, in which case they have to stay on. But if it's just, well, maybe she could remove them, but this is a terrible record and she should have had a hearing and she didn't have a hearing. And so therefore on this record, we're reinstating them. Those are vastly different things that
we can't tell from today's order.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, I think it would be really bold of her to say, okay, fine, we're going to have an evidentiary hearing, when for all she knows, they decided against her on a much sort of more fundamental reason.
And right? Also, I think it would be too soon for her to recuse as well, because she doesn't know what exactly was the basis for what the Supreme Court wants her to do. Is it just to allow them on? And they can be very clear if they're like, we reached the merits, because they talked a lot about that. They said, should we reach the merits here? We don't know if they've reached the merits. And if they have reached the merits and they're essentially directing her not to remove them, no matter what record she thinks she has, then she's in a position of what to do with the recusal motion. But if it's just about having the hearing, and if they kind of touch upon the merits and are like, this is all very concerning, et cetera, and had the court properly had the record made, this would fall within the discretionary duty of the judge. Then no, that would put the cart before the horse to recuse herself. There's no need to do that until she has a hearing. And then, you know, the appellate process can continue. All to say is people who think that today's order that came out shockingly fast, did something big, but it left, I think, a lot more questions than answers.
Now, given how fast it came out, maybe they're already working on the opinion and have been working on the opinions for the last month. I mean, they might have known going in, we're 4-1, we're 3-2 or whatever.
Yeah. You know, the word on the street majority. Is 2 weeks.
How many?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. They're going to get, it's going to be a quick
Which
turnaround.
Is kind of a long time in a 70-day trial, you know, if you really wanted a 70-day trial.
I honestly don't think that they're going to, I don't think they're going to make the demand now. I think that they're smart enough to know that, because they're both highly, like these guys, like they were taking a lot of shit, but I'm just telling you that they're both good attorneys. Brad Rosie's
no, they have great reputations. I think even the justice or the, you know, the litigant for, Judge Gold said, I have a question
they're
for you.
They're highly confident.
Oh, well, I love
highly
that.
Highly confident.
In other circumstances.
Such a glorious moment. I was just sitting there with a shit eating.
So obviously, if the order came out within hours of the end of the hearing, so as we know, probably what happened is they adjourned and the justices probably went back to a conference room and did a preliminary vote. And then they issued out this order. But that was a fast order. So I tend to think they probably had made up their minds before they even had oral argument. Why have oral argument if you know how you're going to come out? And why not just save everyone the time and the media circus and not issue this like kind of quick order that doesn't explain their reasoning and wait the additional 2 weeks and release the whole opinion with their reasoning? So why have oral argument if I think they already made up their minds?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if it's just because, you know, like you want everyone to feel like they had the opportunity to be heard, which is often an issue, under the law, people wanting to be heard.
Can I cut in really quick there to ask you a follow up on that? I agree with you, but I tend to find in my experience that courts want people the opportunity to be heard if they're going to rule against them. So in this case, it would be that Rosie and Baldwin had the opportunity to be heard because below, maybe they haven't been heard. But if they were going to rule for them, why?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was just because I can answer the second part, I think, more easily. And I think it's because you cannot remove somebody's lawyer. So I'm telling you right now, without telling you why, put the lawyers back. And I think that they consider it to be such a serious and such a black and white issue that no matter what other thing we have to say in this opinion, what we know for sure is the lawyers have to go back, is why they did that so quickly. And we actually had, thankfully, because I've been working on a post-conviction petition and had some other things going on. Remind me his name and people need to know. I have a horrible memory. Who sent us all the information?
About what?
This morning.
Oh, Lord. Travis. So I was actually just like, Travis did some actual math for me. Cause he's like, 10 and 60 on both sides is 120, Bob. I'm like,
I had that. I was going to say it.
Hey man, I went to a law school for a reason. Math is not my forte.
But in any event, Travis had sent me some information. Included in that was that this court is known to do that, to issue an opinion really quick. I mean, to issue the writ really quickly and then say an opinion will follow. So I knew that that was, you know, like a possibility of something they could do. I was surprised it came back as quick as it did. But, you know, they may have been amongst themselves. And I don't know, maybe you guys know more because, you know.
Well, I can tell you, if you listen to the argument, which I know we all did, I mean, they really focused a lot on the delay and the cause of the delay. I mean, that was a big sticking point for all five of them up there in terms of the delay that this caused. You know, so I think in terms of them saying, okay, because they unequivocally knew before arguments that they were reinstating them, and they didn't mention Gull. Like the issue of Gull wasn't even broached at all. You know what I mean? They never talked about.
You're right about that. Yeah, right. They never talked about the Judge
Gull. Because they'd already decided that.
Well,
too.
So I may sound like I'm recycling arguments as before, but if this was such a a necessary remedy, that they had to rush out this order within hours of, you know, the courtroom closing, they didn't have to have argument. They
so that's what I was going to ask you.
I think that's really interesting. Remember, there was another writ, mandamus writ filed with respect to the unsealing of documents, which they ruled upon much more quickly than this one because they had to wait through the holidays. They had to set oral argument, which, as you know, you call the litigants and you say, are you available this week? Are you available this week? And then they had to like get it set up for argument. So if in fact we are talking about, like, we cannot wait another day, we cannot let another night go by because someone's constitutional rights are violated.
Right.
You would think that they'd do this, like, you know, months ago, not wait another
day. Sarah's husband and I were having that exact conversation. And he already.
But Alice, is it possible that the justices, knowing they had certain disagreements amongst themselves, do it for their purposes of their dissent and of their opinion and have that conversation there?
Great question. So what you're touching upon is that sometimes, and we see this more at the Supreme Court because of the nine justices and there, you know, there's a lot of differing opinions and jurisprudences, is that you'll use questioning at oral argument to advocate that justice's own opinion about how the case should go in order to sway your fellow justices. In this case, they didn't seem to be on opposite sides, which is what's so weird. So it didn't seem like, you know, one of them was asking questions in a way to pose hypotheticals that would reach another justice's concern. So yes, that is a tactic for justices. I didn't see that here, but I do have a theory as to why they had oral argument. One of them may be that they felt strongly about the fact that below, Rosie and Baldwin did not have a right to be heard. And so they did not want to essentially chastise Judge Gull for doing that if they weren't going to do the same thing, because they recognize that the entire nation is watching them and the rest of the nation may not know that you can have lots of orders from a Supreme Court with no oral argument. That's slight. Secondary, it might just be because they know this is probably one of the most watched cases in the nation, and maybe they wanted it to be transparent what they were doing. Or maybe they wanted people to understand how oral arguments at Supreme Court go. Or maybe they just felt pressure that if they did anything short of an oral argument, they would come under attack that somehow justice is done behind a veil, even though they were doing something that was providing the relief that was being asked.
I think it was
them.
A combination of all of those things, to be honest.
I also think there's the aspect of sort of court management that the Supreme Court of a state has to be involved in. And one thing that I think came across very clear, which, I mean, I think you can remove a lawyer for gross negligence, put that out there. But the thing that we always criticize Judge Gull for is have the hearing, make the record, write the opinion. And I think the one thing that definitely came across to anyone watching this today and any judge who's watching it, any lower court judge in Indiana, Have the hearing. Develop the record. The chief was all about that.
She couldn't have had it that
right?
day, though. Like, and we've disputed this point between you and I, Brett. Like,
well, then have it the next day. I mean, have it a week later, whenever.
Right. I mean, give him a week. She's got to give him a little time to prep to get witnesses there. You know what I mean? But yeah, have the hearing. Like, that was always my point. Actually, make the motion sua sponte. Don't insinuate it. You know? Yeah. Well, like. That line that she told Baldwin, she's like, you know, like he's like, I'm not good at reading the forest's trees or, you know, and she's like, you're a lawyer. That's what you do for a living. You know, it's like, no, file the motion, let them know, give notice to the defendant. It's not about Baldwin and Rosie. It's about Richard Allen. On the 19th, the man was never even brought into the courtroom to hear that his counsel had withdrawn. He was not sitting in the courtroom. That's ridiculous. It's unheard of. It's she was playing on tilt, man. Like it was like she was so upset. Like that whole thing, the way it went down, and I watched it develop. You know, I was sitting in the courtroom when just the parade of officers walk in and sit in the jury box and just sit there for an hour. You know, it's like I'm granting your motion for the camera. Oh, and Mr. Rosie, I just want to let you know that was your motion. You know, be careful what you wish for. Type thing. And then she goes, and I mean, we've seen the transcript at this point, what happened back there, you know, cause everybody's saying, oh, she's offering them an olive branch. She's like a graceful bow out. No, that was like from a defense attorney's perspective, that was an absolute ambush in terms of, yeah, they may have known, but like, if you're going to do it, give proper notice. It, like, due process just requires it. You know, it was,
well,
one
if you
of
know,
those
it's not an ambush. Like, I mean, I'm just saying.
Oh, it was totally an ambush. You know? Absolutely an ambush.
I think it was very interesting that you say that, because even, Rosie and Baldwin's own, attorney kind of went through the timeline of, he's like, there's been a lot of lawyering, you know, of everything that's been happening. So whether you think, you know, several weeks is ambush or not, there,
but it's not
there
actual
was
notice of a hearing, Alice. It, like, talking
there
about.
There was an email that said, I'm going to have a hearing, and I'm telling you, I mean, he literally said that today. His attorney said, their attorneys said that today. They had an email exchange. I agree with you that the email exchange seemed to come after a phone conversation that wasn't on the record. Look, we've been very critical about the fact that a lot of this has happened not on the record. And we, you know, we have to have everything on the record. That's not how I practice law. When our judges forget to do something like that, we stop all conversation and ask court reporters to come in to have the, you know, in chambers conversation. So we are very critical about that. But in terms of no notice, maybe not on the official docket, but there was certainly conversation between the judge and the parties about what she was leaning towards and that she was going to have a hearing.
But leaning towards isn't enough. Like,
no, but no. Like, just the hearing. What she was leaning
towards. That's what I mean. Like, if you're going to have the hearing, give them proper notice.
Then
yes.
why did Rosie and Baldwin?
Because they're not idiots. Rosie.
No.
Surely, Bob,
why did they hire an attorney?
She just stuck something on the docket.
They're not idiots. They knew.
So they knew.
Well, she knew.
That's not proper notice.
Wait. How about, I want to ask this. Something I don't think the prosecutors can deny. In order to have proper notice, you need to have the foundation of what is going to be addressed at you. You can't just know, I have a plan to do something that in the law requires you to lay out the factors and the formula by which you are doing it so that you can intelligently respond to the issues. So notice of, I'm going to do something, even if I know what the end result is, without knowing what factors you're relying on to get there or what standard you are using, and being able to call witnesses to address each of them. Because if I understand correctly, when she said we're going to have a hearing, they were responding on the Franks motion, on this, you know, on what? Yes, obviously they were suspicious enough to get a lawyer, but without knowing precisely laid out the standard the judge is using and what she's proposing to do about it, I don't know how you can have witnesses to confront that.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I think what she should have done is she should have given them 2 weeks. They should have had a full hearing. She should have destroyed them in the hearing. They should have put on all the evidence. It should have been an absolute public just beat down of these two lawyers. And then maybe this hearing today goes differently. I think the fact that they not only hired a lawyer but filed a memorandum shows that they knew what they were arguing about. I think she totally messed this up. I think she tried to save some time. You know, if you want to be charitable to her, not embarrass them.
I think she was also trying to do a solid to them. I think it was a complete error for her to do that. But I'm just saying, I think she messed up there because she didn't want to embarrass them publicly.
That was a solid.
If they had just withdrawn and gone away, I mean, if it really was the most embarrassing day of Baldwin's life or whatever it was he said, I mean, Baldwin didn't seem like he was that upset. Rosie seemed like he was totally angry.
Was destroyed, but like, Brad's an aggressive lawyer. Baldwin, like, in all pretrial, like, so Baldwin is way more laid back. Brad's super aggressive. Like, he's like a real A-type personality.
And that comes across.
Yeah, and it does. But like, it trial, you know, what Andy does is he gets aggressive. Like the kind of good cop, bad cop it in a sense. And, you know, the fact of the matter is when you have a situation like that, again, like everything that Allison was saying, but when she finally gives them actual notice as to what the points exactly what Allison was saying was that morning. So they had no opportunity to be able to prepare anything. And like, I just disagree with you guys completely in terms of anything that they did even being close to being gross negligence.
So we have not, I mean, first of all, we agree on the notice issue. We think that was a complete mess up. But this was mentioned at the oral argument today, and I think it's a valid point to discuss, is that when we have been surprised in court, and it's happened to all four of us all the time, because judges do this from time to time, or a new piece of information comes up, or someone testifies to something no one knew about, and we're all caught flat-footed, what do? You call for a recess or a continuance of the trial until, the hearing, so that you can do your proper investigation, call the right witnesses, and they didn't. They didn't do that there. Now, you could say that because it was such a heated moment, they knew how the judge was going to come out, but that was the whole point in the oral argument today that the justices did kind of pound on, which is that, no, the hearing didn't happen, so we actually don't know how it would have come out ultimately. It probably would have gone, you know, even the Judge Gull's attorney conceded, yeah, probably would have gone the same way, that she would have had the hearing and removed them. But they didn't take any of the actions you typically do as an attorney to buy that time so you can properly respond to the legal standard and the allegations that you now know are going to be alleged against you.
So what was it? So he knew that the legal standard alleged against him. I don't know. Are you guys saying that exists? That there's some, there's some, like, so I, you know, like we all know as lawyers, if you're going to respond to something, you need to have actual notice of like something legitimate to respond to. So there I feel like you can't just say something that's not true and then I'm supposed to respond to it. But two other points I want you guys to respond to. One, the other justice, and I think he was the fourth one down, or it doesn't matter. It's how I kind of was writing in my notes because I couldn't see their names. But he said when he was questioning them, either on rebuttal or he might have thrown it at Gull's lawyer, you know, why, when she was very clear that it's happening right here or it's happening out there and we're doing this now. So what are we doing? Why should we hold that against the lawyers that they didn't go out and do it? Because she was abundantly clear, I'm doing this no matter what. And then my follow-up to that is, even after you guys read the transcript, like the actual transcript, you think she was still trying to help them save face?
Well, that transcript only got released because the defense wanted it released. I think she absolutely was going to do it. Let them go and move on. Now, look, you can question whether or not she really was trying to save face or not. Maybe she's just lazy, didn't want to do the hearing. Maybe she was just trying to save time. I think it was a combination of both. I think she was trying to save time and she didn't want to dress down these two lawyers in front of everybody, but was willing to do it if that's what we're going to do. My biggest problem is in trying to save a little time, like instead of, I mean, I'm fine. Give them 2 weeks. Give them a month. I don't really care how long they could have. They could have as long as they wanted. And whatever time she thought she was saving, we've wasted. You know, we've now wasted 3 months where basically nothing happened and we're back to where we were in October. So like, I am not happy with Judge Gull and how she did this.
I think she was throwing her weight around, period. And she's still throwing her weight around.
Well, I think she was really mad at these lawyers for what they did. And I think that was justifiable. Maybe she went too far.
I mean,
they released photographs of. I have a top secret security clearance. Okay. I have a certain responsibilities when it comes to secret information. If I leave that laying on my desk and a friend comes in and takes a picture or the janitor takes a picture, I don't get to say, well, I trusted people. Oh, they betrayed my trust. No, I get in trouble.
Yeah, but
they made a mistake, a huge mistake.
This
is worse. This is so much worse. No. Well, obviously, you've never had top secret security clearance because most of it's classified as BS. This is photographs of two dead girls, one of whom is nude.
Yeah, but Brett, you know what?
Leaving that where someone could find it is awful. Just say it's awful. You can still think they shouldn't be removed. It's still awful.
Have you ever been to a defense attorney's office in the middle of a trial like this ever? Like, have you ever?
It's not a trial. We're not in trial, though.
That's not the point. They're preparing for trial.
Preparing for a trial.
So we have a war room, and we don't have offices like y'all. We don't have a secretary who sits there in a locked door where when I need to come talk to a prosecutor, I ask the receptionist. They'll call back, and they'll come out and meet me. This
you can't lock your door?
No. Let me finish. It's a different circumstance. Like you're comparing apples and oranges. It's two completely – when we had Garcia – like we had a war room where we had everything out because it's impracticable to put things away every single day.
And but did okay, you let everyone come in there? There's a difference.
And it's also impracticable that if I have to go to the bathroom that I have to remember to lock the door in my own office. That's not realistic.
It's different to let people walk around. I agree with you. When I'm in the heat of everything and I had top secret clearance for a decade, you never let someone walk around unaided when you know something is under a protective
order. That's not how defense attorneys
I don't understand why you can't just admit that this was a mistake. I'm willing to admit that Judge Gohl made mistakes in how she did this. Just admit that what they did was a huge error that was very detrimental, not only to the families and the victims.
So if your home was potentially robbed, so if your home gets robbed,
his office wasn't robbed.
He didn't have an alarm.
His office wasn't robbed. He invited the robber in and said, hey, hang out with all the stuff. Don't take anything. And then left.
No.
Like, just admit that what he did was wrong.
The robber just admit.
Is it the same as calling him a leaker? That's my point to you. You said, if I let someone in, then aren't you just you made not a horrible mistake?
Under a court order and under like top secret clearance rules, if you are the source of that leak, because the documents did not come from the prosecutor's office, they did not come from some other person, then yes, you are the leaker. We get trained, I mean, we have to get trained every like 2 months for top secret clearance. That is absolutely how they define it. And I think that's correct there, because otherwise, how do you stop these from getting out? Are you saying that no additional measure should go back to the way that they practiced before, which is to let anyone come in and be able to have the
additional measures? You know, he's like, okay, well, I'm going to keep the office locked now, but
yeah, afterwards,
the fact of the matter is that when Westerman went into that office, he was going in as an operative. He had a plan. I don't know if there's a will, there's a way. I don't know what could have been done. Again, it's not a lockdown office in the sense that you guys are used to. This isn't a top security type case. Yes, we never want pictures to be leaked. Let me finish it up.
Okay.
But here's what I'm trying to tell you is at some point you have to look at, did it affect Richard Allen's trial, his right to a fair trial? And it didn't. You can say that it did. Yes, we're all concerned.
If the prosecution had leaked it, you would say it did.
Well, I'm not.
If the prosecution had leaked crime scene photos.
No, I wouldn't be. No, I wouldn't.
Yes, you would. So you don't think if the prosecution released these photos and the jury saw them, that would have a negative impact on the jury?
But somebody released, those are two different things. Did they release them?
Negligently left them on the park bench, whatever you want to say.
You guys realize that this
by the grace of God. Nobody's seen them, and they're probably still out there.
Long before Allen was even arrested. You guys realize that, right? That the tree thing was out there long before Allen.
I'm not talking about the tree thing, Bob.
I'm talking about
the pictures of the bodies, okay? And we as attorneys have a higher duty. We're not normal people. We have an obligation to the bar, to the law, to the court, to our clients, to the victims.
You guys realize that these are all coming out at trial, right? These are
No, they're not.
No, they would never be public.
You and I will never see those photographs.
Right, the just courtroom the jury.
The courtroom,
which is different than the
jury will. It's not even clear that the courtroom will.
The gallery will definitely see them.
No. When we do child pornography cases, that is not to the gallery whatsoever.
We turn off screens all the time.
The crime scene itself is part of the evidence in the case. They're going to have to show the pictures.
You can have evidence. There can be certainly you've had cases where certain highly sensitive information have to do with naked, dead children are not released to the gallery. We sometimes go off screen. Well, I'm just explaining it for people who may not have had these trials. We sometimes go completely off screen and hand out paper copies to the jurors to make sure that there's no accidental viewing by the rest of the courtroom, even if we were to seal the courtroom. Because there are certain things that, even if it's coming out in trial, is part of the evidentiary record, is not for public consumption. And there are court orders surrounding that.
They won't even tender us copy if it's like a child pornography case. We don't even, well, they don't tender it. We have to come in and observe it in the office. So yeah, no, like 100%. What I'm suggesting is this is a different scenario in that the way that the crime scene looks, and we've all speculated on what it is. We know that now four attorneys think that there's something to it. You know, it's part of the evidence. It's beyond just what the conditions of the girls were in. I mean, it's going to have to be looked at.
All I'm saying is they shouldn't be on Reddit. The pictures of those girls
I agree on that. Obviously, I don't want the leak to have happened, Brett.
Okay. So then you agree with me that was a bad thing. They shouldn't have been removed.
Obviously, it was a bad thing.
Okay, we're making progress.
I'm not assigning as much blame.
I think Bob's point is
lawyer.
That it's That's not when saying. You say he did a horrible thing. He did a horrible thing. When you put it in perspective, he made a bad judgment call and trusted a friend to come into an area that somehow, some way, he gained access to those things. There's not any telling, like he left it on a table. Bob's saying this guy went in with a plan. So if you've got a plan, if you're in my office and you've got a plan, Bob's point was we don't have the doors locked. Now we would never have like pictures like that out, but they're
in a cabinet.
And if you're looking and you want to open it, that cabinet wasn't locked because we never wanted everyone's, you know, like going to go grab a key somewhere that they could find it. So what he did may have had a horrible outcome, but like I used to say, this silly like way to do it, but I think it's great. Like, you know, you'd have this stigma, right? Late in high school, if you were pregnant, you know, like talking when we were younger, you're like, oh, I got pregnant. You got a pregnant teenager. And I'm saying, you guys are all doing the same thing that caused her to get pregnant. So why are you acting like she's the end of the world? So it's like you're penalizing him for the outcome when what he actually did wasn't so horrible.
Can I ask this though? I am very, very curious about this because I know my answer. Have either of you ever been under a protective order by the court and it accidentally, not intentionally, violated it in this manner? I have not.
I have, I guess.
Callie, I'll let you take it.
I have, although I...
And that's fine. I think that's helpful for people to hear. I have not. Yeah. And
I had a child that was very similar to this. The Garcia case was very similar to this in a lot of ways. The one distinction is that it was in a different jurisdiction and we were in on a pro hoc vice, which means you apply to the court for a limited license to try the one case. So, and we had to have a sponsor from, you know, Douglas County, Nebraska in order to try the case out there. So, you know, I mean, it was exceptionally similar in a lot of
But I want to explain because it wasn't like this. It was, right, it was we different. Got material on a corresponding case where we thought that was similar crime. I'm like, found out that there was this other crime that was so similar 3 months before, 3 miles away, blah, blah, blah. So we got it, right?
MO, for a strange MO, the MO was the same.
Right. So I gave my expert, and we did have sheets that we had to give to people, you know, like to sign, but I gave my expert the DNA to cross compare the DNA there with the DNA at our scene. And then I spoke on the fact that we got results that indicate a low level of DNA from, so it ended up being the fact that I talked about something I couldn't have known, but for the document that was protected, violated the protective order. So not in the same manner, but.
I would say a very different manner. Yeah. I would say in a very, very different manner.
I just want to be clear. The leak was a horrible thing. No, leaks of dead, beautiful girls should never get out to the public. Can I just make that clear? What I am talking about is the amount of blame to assign to Andy Baldwin for it. That's what I'm talking about. They're two completely separate things. Leak, horrible, horrible. I saw on how much blame that you guys are assigning to him for that happening under his watch is what we're in disagreement.
Okay. So what do you do?
That's my thing.
I'm really glad to hear you say that. It is horrible because I think a lot of people are really look to you guys for the defense perspective. And a lot of people don't know how to think about it because of the two things you're saying. There's the actual leak and I'm glad we all agree it's horrific. Yes, it is horrible. So what, we can just sit here and say, this is horrible. Nothing we can do about it. Is that where we sit as attorneys? The court can't do anything about it?
We could have sanctioned him in 20 different ways to where he feels.
So you agree he deserved to be sanctioned. It's just the degree of sanction.
Up to the judge's discretion? Real legal question. Is the amount
to sanction
of
him?
Sanction yes, up to the discretion of the judge? And is there a spectrum of what
until it runs afoul of the Sixth Amendment? Yes, right. Yes, it is. Sanctions were well within play. She could have, like what they suggested, you know, like dock our pay for a week, which would have been, you know, $8,000-$10,000. They would have felt that. That would have been like, you know what? Get it right. Knock it off. All the bullshit that you got going on, I'm done with it. You know what I mean? Like, she had an opportunity to do things other than rip them off the case, you know, and to me, and like, I don't want to get conspiratorial, but when you look at who benefited from the leak the most up until today happened, it was the state.
Yeah, I mean, you would admit that the defense does not want that, you know, horrible pictures of victims getting released to the public. That's not.
So we now agree that it was prejudicial to Richard Allen for those photographs to be out, because 10 minutes ago it seemed like you were saying that wasn't a big deal.
He's saying it didn't get out. Right.
Only because the people who took them didn't put them online. Like, there were people who received those. You know that. It was just lucky. It's like driving home drunk. You know, like, thank God you didn't run into anybody. It's like Allie was saying about you're doing the same thing, but nothing happened. Okay, well, they didn't make it to Reddit, so therefore, not protecting this isn't a problem. I mean, look, I think we all agree that it was a problem. I totally understand your argument that Judge Gull overreacted, that she went too far, that was beyond her discretion. I do think, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I think if Judge Gull was going to take this extreme measure, she should have had the hearing. She just should have had the hearing. And I don't know what would have happened. I mean, maybe the Supreme Court would have said the same thing. I will say this, if she'd have done that.
I'm going to tell you this. The Supreme Court would have said the same thing.
Look, there are dissents in this case. So there's at least some justices who agree that even under this record, they shouldn't have reinstated them. So who knows with an actual record?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's because they didn't ask for the remedy of their filing of their appearance to be accepted when they were private counsel. They only asked to get reappointed as the court appointed attorney. And I suspect when you're court appointed, the court has a little bit more say because they're the ones literally, you know, appointing you.
No, but that's right. I mean, that's absolutely right. And you're right.
But again, and that's where I'm saying, I've always said, the right to continuity of counsel is not as black and white, although it's there. It's there if you want to find it. And one of the judges said, can we start today? And she said it's the attorney general, who obviously is more forthcoming than if they would have asked Gull's lawyer, that we start with the presumption of the right to continuing counsel. And the attorney general, you know, said yes. But you're talking about, they didn't ask for that relief. So that to me is where I'm thinking that they are going, unless it has something to do with the fact that they should never been there in the first place.
Because we actually, like, we had had Kara on Alive, and we reached out to her. We're like, are you sure you don't want to add that in? Because, like, she had sent it to us right before it got filed. And I'm like, are you sure you don't want to add that in?
I was like, what is happening?
Yeah, she's like,
I think y'all really underestimate how much they don't want to be pro bono counsel. I mean, that would be, they'd like go to the poorhouse to do that.
I mean, can you imagine how expensive
that would
be?
You guys know? Are you kidding?
Yeah, well, then why do you think they would want to do that?
They didn't
want to do it. But the law firm to do it.
It's a good, it was a good, like, legal sort of
argument to get into the.
Yeah, it was like a good, public thing. Like, we're so committed, we'll do this for free, but they don't actually want to do it for free.
If the trial would have dragged on for 2.5 years, it would have been suicide for their practice.
It would have decimated their practices.
I can tell you.
So, but if they were really going to trial,
I'm going to give the real answer to that. At least from what my understanding is from speaking with them is that, and it was basically what the lawyer came back in rebuttal, because I can tell you when he was asked, right then and there, hey, do you want to ask me for some additional relief? You didn't ask me, because I was playing this on mute, because people need to hear it. But I'm back there going, yes, please say it. Yes. You know, and he was like, no.
No.
But He came, he's sort of revisited.
I will say though, I think it's because he read the room after that question. He's like, I'm going to win anyway.
Yeah, I don't need to do this for free.
To be totally honest, I probably would have, he knew he was winning. And so he's like, might as well ask for the whole kit and caboodle.
But the real reason that I was told was like, they want this precedent out there so that the judges know you can't even do this. And they felt so strongly that they can't even do this, that they weren't going to pitch them a softball that they could fall back on and be like, we don't have to get to this because you know what? You're not allowed to do this, being the other, this being remove private counsel of choice. So that's why they chose not to. It was more of a like defense bar move, but they researched it first, obviously to determine it's in the best interest of the defendant because they felt very like 100% with all the people who had researched that they would say they couldn't even do it as court appointed. So that was why they did it.
I mean, I that was only joking aside, but the rebuttal was very clear, saying that it would be a half measure, remedy if they had to do it for free. And in reality, we've said this before too. These trials, these investigations leading up to the trial are expensive. Experts are expensive. Absolutely. If they had to do this for free, when they asked to do it pro bono, both of us chuckled because we're like, they can't. They literally can't because it's too expensive to do it. But I understand your point as to it's not because they're caring about their own bottom line. I would care about my own bottom line. I don't think that's a problem. You need to like turn on the lights in your office building.
I like to eat.
I like to eat. Yeah. I like to, you know, drink bubbly water.
Kids,
but I understand you're saying that they're doing it for the legal reason. And also I think that attorney was smart and read where the questioning was going. And it was already in his favor by that point of the rebuttal. And it's always a nice feeling when you get up for rebuttal and you're thinking, I got this bench.
Yeah.
Bob, it sounds like you think no matter what, we're still going in October. They're not going to move for an earlier trial.
I think they are. I just don't think
they are.
Okay. Yeah. It's because if the 70, yeah, I just think that they're going to wait to figure out what they're doing with their motion to recuse her and whether or not she's going to. And like you guys aptly noted, they need to see the opinion. They can't go in blind on either of those hearings without knowing what the Supreme Court is weighing in on. Because
I mean, don't you want to press the motion to recuse sooner than later? Because you got the Franks motion hanging out there.
Yeah, I want to. You're going to recuse, man. I want to press all of it sooner. You know, it's like you said. I mean, 3 months have been wasted, like where this could have been time well spent, and whether or not they would have gone to trial on the 8th. You know, the one thing that we know, you know, if you've got two lawyers that have been on it for a year, she's not kicking it till October 15th of 2024. If she kicks it to March, fine. You know what I'm saying? It's like whatever the case.
Now they gotta get all the, you know, they gotta get all the stuff back because they gave it all back. They gotta get it re-sort of, because I'm sure they had it organized in a way that was easy for them. And I mean, it's gonna take a little time for them just to get all that together.
For sure.
And I want to ask you guys, you being the prosecutors, because Bob told, because I said to Bob, well, all right, let's assume they just filed that. They set that motion to get heard for the removal of the judge. And apparently he was told by multiple lawyers in Indiana that there is no method to raise bias. Substitution of judge for cause, in my experience, never goes before the judge for cause. If you want to say a motion to consider recusal, then you're asking the judge. You're saying, judge, do you think you have a conflict? There's this like little issue over there. So, but Bob said that they don't have a method. And to me, it makes no sense that there wouldn't be a way to file a motion for bias and that motion would never get heard in front of the judge.
So, I mean, at least here, and I guess it sounds like in Indiana, yeah, the judge decides their own recusal motions. Now, the thing that I wondered is if she denies it, can they interlocutory appeal? Can they mandamus her? I mean, I feel like mandamus, that's funny. In most states, mandamus is a pretty rare thing, but I feel like mandamus is something you can do when a judge refuses to recuse.
That's what they said. When I was sitting at the table, I had the conversation and that's when it came up and I was with Lehman and Kara and I said, well, you know, the recusal motion is still pending. I'm assuming like, who are they going to bring in that for that? And they're like, what are you talking about? It'll be Gull. I'm like, Gull? I'm like, this isn't a conflict of interest. It's a bias Like, I mean, it's a completely separate thing. I mean, how could, like, for us fundamentally, Alice and I were like, wait, how can a judge, of course they're not going to say they were biased. They're like, that,
I mean, does not have something called substitution for cause where you're asking the judge be removed.
And no one used that.
And it's really interesting. It's interesting that I agree with you. It's really awkward when you're making those arguments before the judge. But I mean, in those situations, you almost always know it's going to be appealed. And in some cases, mandamus. And so the judge is cognizant of that. It is an awkward hearing, awkward as all get out, but that is what happens in our jurisdiction, as well. So, I mean, it doesn't typically happen that often. I don't know what jurisprudence is in Indiana.
If I was Gull, I would seriously consider recusing at this point.
Yes. Like, I mean, here's my prediction. My prediction is at the recusal, when that comes, she's going to get on the bench just to say, look, and she's like, not going to allow them to cast shade on her. She's going to say, look, I've just been appointed. I had some health issues coming into the new year. I've just been appointed the chief judge of a very large county. It's a ton of extra duties. And my docket is packed. Mm-hmm. I am concerned about the fact of being able to leave my county now as chief judge for 6-8 weeks, however long this trial is going to take, for solid. Maybe somebody can replace. But I think if I'm her, I'm like, what is the benefit for her staying in this thing? It's like dealing with this shit. Like
I don't even think she has to give a reason, to be totally honest. You know,
that's what I'm saying. She
like,
doesn't.
I have a judge who had a case for like 3 years, and this particular defendant was like really just crazy, not mentally, but like the tactics were exhausting for everybody. And finally, that judge was just fed up and recused himself with no explanation. We all knew why. He was tired of it.
See, but in a case like this, like that train has left the station. Like she couldn't do it without saying something. Like in our case, our judge.
Well, you're right. She has lots of excuses. I mean.
Well, I mean, it's not even like she does. And she could bow out gracefully. If people are going to snicker, so be it. Who cares? I mean, she's got bigger aspirations. She's tried to get in the high court 3 times, you know, so she wants to get up there, you know, and like that's what her end goal is. Like, why torture yourself with this?
I think she's lost her chance with this.
I don't necessarily know that. I think she's a respected jurist.
Seemed pretty irritated.
Alice, I agree with you. I don't think she benefits from staying on the case professionally at all. Right? Like oftentimes you do benefit when you are a judge presiding over a very high profile case. In this situation, because of all the history, if I were her, I'd be looking for ways to get out.
Get the hell out. I think she just recuses herself. Like, but I mean, she'll wait. Till that hearing. That's what I'd do it if I were her. I just say, like, you know what? I'm good.
Putting all that aside, I mean, we're kind of being cynical about why she might recuse. But I mean, I just think as a judge, you now have a very acrimonious relationship between you and the defense attorneys. And look, there are plenty of defense attorneys that judges don't like, right? I mean, they're repeat players that judges have to deal with in every case and they don't like them. But this has become a very acrimonious relationship.
Oh yeah.
And you have the appearance issue. I mean, even if she can totally put all that aside and roll down the line on these guys,
follow the law, everybody's still going to be everything that she rules against them. Everybody's
like, they literally just asked for a mandamus to remove her, right? They didn't get it granted, but like they are the lawyers who asked for it. Right. And that appearance is there. Absolutely.
Baldwin told me a story that he picked up a murder case in Allen County, and guess who his judge is? So he goes in there and he's like, she wouldn't even look at him. Hmm. You know, she was this is like 2 weeks ago, so it's like leading up to it, but it's like
some states actually have it where you can force recuse a judge. You get one opportunity.
We have that.
That's us.
You have that?
Yeah. As long like prior to a
substance. It's a class X2. We can name 2. I want a substitution of judge. And
you can
don't
name
give
the
me.
Substitute. Wow.
No. Oh, no. And don't give me.
Oh, and don't give judges. Me. Okay.
Oh, right. I see. Okay.
Huh. That's
we don't get to do that.
You have 10 no. days.
They don't in Indiana either.
You have to do it within 10 days of this getting on that judge's docket or before they make a substantive rule. Once they do that, you have a substitution.
So that you can't game the system and whatnot.
Right. Then you have a substitution for cause. And I have gone in on one, one where it was a civil case. So the client felt that the judge was prejudiced, and that was assigned to another judge. I've never been on one where that judge hears that. But then Bob and I had a case where the judge, so we're obviously in front of all the same judges all the time. So this whole, you're in front of the same judge. We have a judge that we're on trial with who literally, and he is the only defense bar judge on the bench in this particular county, but he literally basically called us liars, cheaters, and stealers, like in no uncertain terms, and yelling and screaming. He's, you know, like that, was like quoting off of our website. And then I had a trial in front of him. Yeah. And then I had to do a trial in front of him not that long after that, right? Like it was going to bench. So there was a lot of tension there. And in that trial, we had an issue come up where the family of my client was saying that they were there when they went to do the police interview. The father like was in there with them, and I never got any information like that. And so I sort of just put it to the side of my mind, like they're misremembering. Whatever they think happened didn't happen. They were so persistent. I remember calling the father on the phone, and he described to me where he drove. Not a normal spot, but a spot that they have. And then the mom tells me, I have the voicemail that the cop left me after they left. And it said, he just left. He and his father were here, blah, blah, blah. So this cop's on the stand, and I'm questioning about this interaction, and I just had the dad take a picture. I'm like, go to where you were and take a picture. So, and I ask him, and then he denies it. And he gets off the stand. And then the judge, he's literally like top of his lungs, red faced. And he's saying that am I trying to tell him? This cop, he is known for 20 years, just sat on the stand and lied. Am I about to call a witness to say that? Because if I am, and I can't prove it, he is reporting me to the ARDC, like screaming. And then he, of course, is like, and if she can prove it, you know, you guys over there are in trouble too. So I'm like, you need to get home.
That's the pressure.
He told me to prove it, right? You need to get home and go through all those old phones and find that damn voicemail, because the world's coming to an end right now. So she went to go find those things. In any event, all of a sudden, the state finds the Miranda warning. The dad's name is on it. He was there. It happened. There was an interview. So a couple of days later, the judge, when the trial's over, he commends Bob and I. Now it's an empty courtroom.
Of course.
Playing through us in a packed courtroom.
What a delight we have. What a, like, just the bench, the defense bar is so lucky to have us. More people should fight like us. And, you know, to this day, he still loves me. But before that, he had it in his mind that, you know, we are lying, and now he thinks I'm going to put on.
So, I think with Bob and his hat on, I just have to say, I think everyone in the chat thinks this. It really is such a pleasure to have this conversation with you guys, because I think in a day and age where civil discourse is lost, where we can have different opinions about the law and still be friends and be able to, you know, discuss it in an intelligent manner, is really, we need more of it, not less. So I just wanted to say thanks while Bob is wearing a hat, because why not? And maybe this is a good time to do our wrap ups without having to sign off. Do you guys want to do that?
We should do it again. Cause it was super.
We should absolutely do it again.
Like, no, I was like, wait, dude, this same
I don't
thing?
Even need this to be.
All right, everyone, again.
This was just fun. Fun. Like, I could have done this even if we didn't have people watching us. It was just
what we got. Agreed. You know, we got the Murda 3-day evidentiary.
Oh,
here
my.
The
that's
the
right. Yeah. Coming up.
They got slammed. Man.
They did.
But before
the value
we get
of having a hearing.
I just can't get over Bob in this hat. I'm sorry.
Bob,
I'm going to direct a serious question at you. Look fantastic in the hat. You know I'm a Texan. I love that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Before we sign off on talking about this hearing, I agree with you. I hope we have many more conversations about all types of cases. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us as, you know, the arguments ended and physically being in the court? You know, what the mood was in the court, and any last thoughts you may have?
The mood in the court was obviously like, I didn't see anybody from the families that looked overly upset, you know, cause remember Patties were there, you know, so the families were there. They didn't look infuriated to me. I think, and I hope that they realize, and I've kind of been yammering about this, that this is going to expedite the trial, which I think is a benefit for them. And I think that, you know, if they've got the evidence on Allen and he goes down, then God bless him. Like, they got the guy, you know what I mean? And if they didn't, you know, either way, they need to get to that point where they're not being tortured. This thing's been going on for 7 years. Enough is enough. It would be one thing if Richard Allen's statement hadn't been sitting in a file for 5 years, but the fact of the matter, it was. We can't ignore that. It's much like the things that happened with Huerman, where they had the first generation Green Avalanche in the Ogre description for 10 years and they chose to ignore this witness. So like from that perspective, I just, for the families, I want this thing to get moving. It's time. I hope that the, whatever happens with the judge, whether she's going to stay on, whether she's going to recuse, that the thing can move forward in a truly judicial and judicious fashion, because that's what the families deserve. You know, I mean, that's, it's the way it's got to go down, you know, and like, this has been a carnival show for long enough. I'm hoping there's going to be some calm in the port now and that everyone can calm down and just go about their business and try the damn case, you know? So that was kind of my vibe from it. Ultimately, because of the structural error that Allison and I like firmly believe that it would have been, I'm relieved for the families. I think it would have absolutely been tried again. Like, I think that Lehman was on the spot when he said this would be a test run trial, you know, and the families would have to sit through the worst day of their life again and hear it for weeks and weeks on end. Like, the thought of that is absolutely devastating to me, you know, like it's unfathomable. Like, I can't even put my mind to a place where I lost one of our four kids to something like this. I can't even get there. Like, I can't. Of course, I have massive empathy, but I can't even bring my, it's so horrible that I can't even enter that zone, you know? So for me, I really want to see this thing get moving along and, you know,
thank you for saying that, Bob. And you know, all four of us, we've had good discussion. We've disagreed some, agreed some, but I think you're right. This is now where we are. Let's move forward and get justice for Abby and Libby. It has been long enough. And this is going to be a very interesting ride all through the end of, you know, a trial. So I hope we have many more discussions like this.
So thank you all for being with us. We, as you know, we adore you. We cherish you. We thank you for giving us your valuable time, because without you, I'd just be an old man.
Talking about a new case.
Talking to you next time.